And good morning. Thanks for tuning in to 88.5 KRFY. This is our listener-supported community radio for North Idaho. And this is the morning show on this beautiful Wednesday, very cold out Wednesday, October 12th. And we're live in the studios, and I'm Susie Prez, one of your co-hosts for this morning show.
And I'm Chris Bessler, your co-host. Susie, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. How are you, Chris?
I'm very well. Thank you.
Good.
Welcome back from your trip from last week.
All the way to Seattle.
Yeah.
I got to go up in the Space Needle, by the way.
Oh.
That was quite, it was like looking at a Google map that was alive. It was really fun. So we have a special show today?
We do. We're in our election series, and today we are covering District 7 legislative districts, races, the contested races. There's one House race that's uncontested. But there is a Senate seat and seat 7A that is up for election that are contested. So we're going to be covering both those races today, and we have all four candidates for those two races. So we're going to break this up into two pieces. We're going to talk first with the District 7 Senate candidates, and then we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back in the second half of the show and do the House candidates.
So first, we have the Senate candidates, Ken Meyer. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning, Susie.
And Carl Crabtree. Good morning, Carl.
Good morning to you, Susie.
All the way from Grangeville, and Ken from Sagal. And you're here today because we want to hear from you. We want our listeners to have an idea of who you are, what's going on, and get a sense of how you stand on some of the important issues that face our area, so that voters can be inspired to go out, register if they're not registered, and get to the polls and vote on Election Day, November 8th.
Yes. And I'm going to mention that District 7 is a tough district. It's probably, by size, the largest district in the state. It stretches from the southern part of Bonner County. It includes Sagal and the portion of the county that's east of Highway 95. And then it runs all the way down to Riggins, which is, Carl, how far is that?
Well, actually, south of Riggins.
South of Riggins, yeah.
Partway to Pollock.
Yeah. And that includes Grangeville. It includes the Silver Valley.
It does, and Orofino.
And Orofino.
Clearwater.
Clearwater. And Carl, you live in
Grangeville.
Grangeville. And Ken, you
live in Sagal.
In Sagal, okay. And Ken, you're the Democrat, and Carl, you're the Republican in this race. But I tell you what, before we jump into the questions, Susie, shall we at least hear what the weather's going to be?
Oh, okay. we'll talk for a second. I have to pull up the weather here. And 7-day forecast from the National Weather Service. And they're telling us that it is currently 25 degrees out. Oh, my goodness. We had a heavy frost, that's for sure. The tomatoes are all gone. High today, 51. Sunny, beautiful out. Tonight, increasing clouds, 31. And tomorrow, 70% chance of rain, high of 48. And Thursday night, that's tomorrow night, a low of 43. So once the clouds come in, it's not so cold. Due to the beautiful sunny sky, we're going to have a cold night tomorrow night, tonight too.
Tonight, yeah. But it's a beautiful day out there. It's fall, classic fall day. And with that, let's get back into the show.
Yep. First of all, we want to really thank both of you for coming in and joining us and helping our listeners get informed. We want to give each of you a brief moment to tell us who you are, how long you've lived in your in this legislative district 7, your background, and why you want to serve Idaho in the capacity of the District 7 Senate seat. So we can start with Carl Crabtree.
Okay.
Good morning.
Thank you, Susie. Okay. Yes, I was, to start off, raised a big city guy, raised between Kuski, population 800, and Stites, population 300, and on a ridge up there. My mother was a school teacher, and my dad worked in the mill and was a cowboy. And so then I graduated from high school there, went to U of I, graduated there, went to work for the University of Idaho. As an extension agent for 10 years, and then worked for the county as a weed supervisor and 4-H person. Did 27 years of that. with the running the 4-H program there. So, well, during this time, even when I was in high school, I owned cattle, and so we built a ranching operation. And my wife did the work, and so that's what we do now. We ranch there. I have been past president of the Idaho Cattlemen's Association. I've been past president of the Idaho Beef Council. I sat on the National Cattlemen's Beef Board and chaired a committee there, a couple of committees, actually national committees, one on producer education, one on evaluation. And the evaluation committee, I think, will lend itself well. We'll talk about that later to some of our legislative needs. Got into this political thing. Never thought I would ever be a politician, but that's, I guess, a claim to fame here. But, you know, there's a lot of push. I've been around political things, like with the Cattle Association a lot, knew a lot of people, but not in partisan politics. And so that's new to me. We're looking forward to hearing from people, trying to learn what people want to talk about. And we have some ideas there. Trying to bring some common sense leadership, expand the conversation from my predecessor to a wider variety of topics. So those are some of the reasons that I'm running and who I am.
All right. Great. Thank you very much. Have you held elective office before, I guess would be one question.
Well, I was elected president of the Idaho Cattle Association, so I guess, but not partisan political office, no.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's start again. Ken Myers, we'd love to hear from you the same thing, your background, why you're running, and who you are a little bit.
Sure. Thank you, Susie. Like I said, I'm Ken Myers, and I'm running for state senate from District 7. I was born in Great Falls, Montana. My folks had a wheat farm north of Great Falls, about 65 miles. And if you could look on a map, there's nothing 65 miles north of Great Falls. So in order to go to school, we had to go, there wasn't a local school, so I had to go to a town. And my grandparents lived in Great Falls, so I boarded with them during the school year in the winter, in the spring and in the fall when my folks did the planting and the harvest, some of the harvesting, and then they would come back in the winter. I was able to go to college. I was the first person in my family to do so and the first person to graduate. I went to Montana State College, I went to Oregon State College, and I received a doctorate from the College of Veterinary Medicine at Washington State University. I became a faculty member upon graduation, and I went and spent 35 years or so at Washington State in the College of Veterinary Medicine as a scientist, as an educator, and an administrator. I learned some things while I was there, and those things, I think, translate into what I'm proposing to do as a legislator. I believe that good things can happen when you have a vision that makes lives of people better. I think we need to keep focusing as we move towards the goal. We need to keep focused on the goal. We need to engage people. We need to listen with respect. We need to gather support and build a consensus. So that's something about who I am. I have never held an elective office as a political office before. I'm a newbie.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Well, let's start out, and you'll go first this time, Ken, would you describe the top two or three issues that are motivating you to run for legislature?
Sure, be glad to. 2008, Idaho experienced the Great Recession, and it was devastating to Idaho. We have had the Republican legislator and the Republican governor to be showing us leadership on how to recover. And if we look at what has happened within the state, we are not doing well. If you look at education, if you look at our economy, we, compared to other states, are not doing well. What they are doing in the legislature, some of that is driving me crazy. And I'm running to because I could either be crazy or I could try to do something. And the things that are the paramount to me, The things that are important to me are having a legislature that is responsive to its citizens, that is an effective legislature. We have a natural resource policies that benefit all the members of the of Idaho. We have a resource policy that ensures that my four children, our seven grandchildren, will be able to have free access. I want to have a legislature that is focused on the economy and on education. And those two factors are not separate from one another, but need to be spoken as one. And we can do that later.
Okay. Well, yeah, well, we will probably dive a little bit deeper in on those. Carl, the same question to you. What are the top issues for you that are motivating you to run for legislature?
Well, the things that have changed a little since I started running, but education, jobs, and this healthcare thing are probably the three that I hear the most about. Some of those are much more difficult to deal with than the others. So Ken talked about the education thing, and I think that's probably a top priority for me based on my background and, you know, my mother and my so forth. So, you know, we kind of gravitate to what you see as most important. And talking around the state, people are concerned about. We balanced the budget during the recession on education in Idaho. Whether we should have or whether we shouldn't have didn't matter. We did. So now we're going to bring some more funds back into it, it looks like. That's what I'm hearing from people at the state. So how are we going to do that? Does more money equal better education? And I think we need to discover a better way of evaluating that. We are among the poorest in teacher pay and cost per student, but does that mean we have a bad education system? Well, maybe. Maybe not. But we don't have an evaluation system. I talked about chairing the National Evaluation Committee with the Beef Board, which had to do with detecting whether we were getting our monies back. And the beef, it's what's for dinner ad, is one of the things we worked on. Well, we were able to evaluate, yes, in fact, that brought back lots of dollars. And it was worth the money. So can we do that in education in Idaho? Can we measure what we're doing with regard to education? If so, then we can determine whether we're getting a bang for our buck and therefore justify different funding.
Thank you very much. And speaking of education, first question would be on that subject. The state's budget for education was cut back drastically in 2009 as the recession took hold. As the economy improved, the legislature has increased school funding. Last session approved a 7.4 increase to $1.58 billion. That was less than the 7.9 that Governor Otter proposed for students in K through 12 schools. Do you favor or oppose increasing funding for education? If you support increased funding, how should the state pay for it? And we'll start with Carl.
Well, whether we support increase in funds has to do with, I think we need some method to evaluate what we're doing in outcomes. Our goal is not to spend money. Our goal is to educate kids, and yet we don't measure that accurately. I had a school superintendent tell me, we change the way we evaluate every couple of years, and he said, if we keep the current trend up, we'll never have to be accountable for any of it. And he was saying that in a joking way, but we keep talking about improving education by just spending money. I'm not big into spending money, and I think we need to make sure we're getting something done. Our goal is not to spend money or to tax people. It is to achieve some outcomes, and that would be better education for our kids.
Just a follow-up question with that, Carl. Having better, as you said, every other year they're coming out with a new way of measuring the outcomes. What would be a solution in your mind to make it more standard and get better statistics and know how to proceed in the educational system?
Well, two things. One is that if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And so we need a measurable system, which we have had. The problem is we change it all the time. I don't think that we need to keep moving the state. You know, you drive in the ground, then you start toward it, then you pick it up and move it somewhere else and move toward that state. I'm not too concerned about what system we have as long as we have a system that we can use to sustain an evaluation over a period of time that would mean something to a legislator or to a taxpayer.
Okay, and Ken Myers, the same question. Are you in favor or oppose increased funding for education? If you support increased funding, how should the state pay for it?
education, we need to become serious about education. We need to fund education properly. Education is the key to a long-term economy. If we look at, I'm going to go back and kind of explain the economy as I see it and how education fits in there, therefore why we have to add, increase our support of education. If you look at the economy, District 7 has been an extraction, natural resource-based economy at the beginning. We use timber, we use mining, we have agriculture in each one of the counties that we have that. It has moved from in the recession, before the recession and during the recession. We're moving now to add, to balance that, because that's a very cyclic nature economy. We're now moving into tourism, and we've put a lot of money and a lot of effort into each one of those. And so we have these two factors, which are our economy. And if you look how successful that has been, District 7 is the poorest county, poorest district in the state. We need to do something else. And what we're doing and apparently doing up here in northern Idaho, in Bonner County, is to move into a technological-based economy where we have new businesses coming in. We're developing new businesses. These are homegrown. We're trying to keep them. In order for us to move into this technological-based economy, we need to have our students trained so that they can enter that job force. We need to continue to focus on this, on what we call STEM, science, technology, math, and engineering. Those are going to be critical. We're going to have opportunities beyond K through 12 for students to get advanced training, and we're going to have to use and have college. And we can talk about those issues at later on in the program. So we're going to have to put money into this, and we're going to have to put money into it in a way that will lead us to the directions which we want to go, which is to have jobs, our students trained for a 21st state economy. How you're going to pay for that, you're going to have to start becoming serious about moving resources into that area, and you're going to have to use funds like when you have when we have giving money off the table for our health.
Are we talking about the Medicare gap?
The Medicare gap. Okay.
Actually, we'll get into that as well. But can you kind of got into the next question, actually? So we're going to go ahead and talk about economy. And why don't we start with you first again, Carl, on this one. The economy and job creation are issues of concern that are identified by almost all of our region's residents, I think. Do you think this is an important issue for the legislature to deal with, not just the free market, but are there things that the legislature can do? And if so, what kind of specific actions can the legislature do to help improve the economy and job creation?
Well, the job problem in our district is, there's some good news and some bad news with regard to jobs. One, the good news is it's better than it was. The bad news is it's the worst in the state. We're at a 7% about unemployment rate in this district. It's down from, I think 17% was the high. Well,
and so that's still a couple percent higher than the rest of the state, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We are the worst.
Yeah.
Now. So what are we going to do about that? And we've got a number of things that are happening now, but I think it ties with our discussion of education. We talked about education needs, and I think maybe they are changing. And one of the things that's changing is the type of education we need to have our students ready for, and that is an actual job, to actually get in the workforce. Not everybody is going to be a PhD. We're kind of preparing a lot of people to be that. That's great. But we need to see that some kids go into what we used to call industrial arts, things that will actually produce a job when they graduate from high school. In talking to some of our economic development people, they believe that that is the next frontier for education, is to prepare kids for actual employment. And so we need to probably see that we get some money from the legislature pointed that direction, if there's going to be an increase in education funding, it certainly needs to be looked at as going into something to prepare people to take jobs and or to get some jobs. There are really some good things going on. The Panhandle Area Economic Council, or PAC or whatever, up here is doing some good things. Orfino, we talked to some people. They're working with trying to get some prisoners to get them out of prison and instead of just turn them loose so they can reoffend, give them a job, prepare them for a job while they're even in prison for some of these things. So those things will help, I believe, our economic situation and job creation in District 7.
Here's a follow-up question that's on the same vein here. Many states are increasing the minimum wage, some to as much as $15 an hour. Washington recently did that in portions of the state. Idaho's minimum is the same as the federal minimum, which is $7.25 an hour. Should Idaho increase its minimum wage?
Well, I'm not an advocate of minimum wage work. I think that is not a living wage. It's not intended to be. And so we need to work at getting people employed and getting jobs. And I'm not in favor of changing the
minimum of increasing wage. The minimum wage. Okay. Ken, same question to you on the economy and job creation. You've kind of spoke about that, but the question would be, do you consider this an important issue for the legislature to work on, and what can legislators do in this area of economy and job creation, since we do have a free market economy that kind of is a huge part of the way our society is set up?
The role of government, it should be to make it a playing field, to provide an infrastructure in which jobs can be created, businesses can be started, and can become successfully. So, yes, we can have a government a role. It does have a role. We have a role in providing an infrastructure so that if we have manufactured goods or we can produce, harvest trees, lumber, those things, we can transport those to the market. So we have roads which are lead themselves to proper transportation of goods and services. We need to have an internet, which we can have as a high-speed internet, which would allow us to communicate again in a 21st century economy. And yes, we need to increase the minimum wage. That money goes back into the community and doesn't leave the community as we raise it. So those would be important issues that we could address as a legislature to increase the economic viability of Idaho.
Same follow-up question for you on the minimum wage. Idaho minimum wage is the same as the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour. Should Idaho increase its minimum wage?
Yes, it should. We are. If you look at the surrounding states, Idaho, if you look over at Montana, Washington, and Oregon, they're all higher than we are. So we do need to increase the minimum wage. It will benefit all the people that are working on minimum wage jobs. That money will stay within the region, and so we should increase it. Everyone will benefit from that.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, another kind of important issue. I'm sure you both know about it. The Affordable Care Act is now in place, and Idahoans signed up at one of the highest per capita rates in the country, about 50,000 enrollments. But one provision in the law permits states to expand Medicaid to cover an estimated 60 to 80,000 Idahoans who make too much to qualify for Medicaid, but not enough to be eligible for subsidies on the state insurance exchange. Last legislative session, lawmakers adjourned without agreeing on a solution. What, if any, action do you favor to cover the health care coverage gap for lower income Idahoans? I guess we start with Ken this time.
Yep. Okay. Yes, we need to close the gap. It is morally and economically correct. This is the thing to do on both issues. As I understand it, we as Idahoans pay federal tax. That tax goes onto a table. The government takes a portion of that, most of it, leaving behind money on the table that could be used to provide health insurance for the working poor. We have decided, Idaho has decided not to take that. That money goes off the table and doesn't come back. It goes back into the government and can be used at other places. We still have the problem of having, we have people who are working poor who aren't insured, and they're going to get health care coverage, and it usually ends up by going to the emergency room. We have an indigent care fund that we have in this Bonner County. We've put about $500,000 into that. So not only are we losing money that we could benefit by bringing the federal government in, we're paying for that almost twice. So we get paid twice for that. So yes, we need to cover that.
Okay. And Carl?
Okay. Well, thank you, Susie. I don't like the idea of government solving all of our problems, okay? I don't like the idea of the federal government trying to come in here and help us solve our problems with regard to health care. That said, the problem is costs. It's not as much who's paying for it, I don't believe, is these costs of medical insurance or medical services, I should say. Then, of course, medical insurance follows that, but we've got to find some way to deal with cost. The problem we've got, the system we have now, these property owners are having to pay for the indigent fund. That comes out of local taxpayers' pockets. And that is $1.8 million in this district. That's not good. And then there's another $6 million to $8 million being absorbed by the hospitals locally to take care of people who didn't pay their bill. So then that's added.
That's the indigent.
Mm-hmm. No, that's not the indigent. That's an addition.
That's additional. I see.
Yeah. Okay.
So what is the solution?
So the solution is ultimately, I think, going to be some sort of a state-run, state-managed solution to the problem. I am very concerned about how this is all going to shake out, and I think now is a poor time to try to figure out what's going to happen at the national level. We will have a change in the presidency. We will have, could have a change in the Congress. And if those things happen, we're going to have a lot of changes in the landscape as to what happens to Idaho. So we can identify the problem, but I think proposing immediate solutions is not what I'm prepared for.
Okay. I want to remind our listeners that this is the 88.5 KRFY Morning Show. I'm your host, Chris Bessler, here with Susie Prez. And we're talking this morning with the candidates for the Idaho State Senate Legislative District 7, Ken Myers and Carl Crabtree. Again, thank you both for being here. Let's turn to another question here. That's a pretty well-debated topic here in our district, and that's public lands. There's an active movement within Idaho promoting the transfer of federal lands to the state. Do you favor or oppose this effort, and why? And let's start with Carl.
Well, the federal land issue is something I'm familiar with. Worked with weeds at the county, state, and federal agency level, and have dealt with this federal debacle for years. It is clear the system we have does not work. I've visited with lieutenants within the Forest Service, retired people who have worked there, and they will not tell you that what's going on now is a good deal. So change has got to happen. Now, whether that change includes turning that to the state, I don't see that probably as reality. I think that there are a lot of people who would be happier, but to be honest with them, I don't see that as happening. In Utah, they used to own the public land. Then it went back to the federal government. In Idaho, we never did apparently own the public. So the idea of getting it back may not work for us. But some sort of a cooperative effort between the federal government and local people to manage these federal lands and have the decisions made closer to the people that are actually living here, I think is required and will increase the support of the Forest Service. The budgets of the Forest Service are going down every year. They're living off of fire money because they can't defend their position in Congress as to what they're doing outside of fire. these cooperative efforts, I believe, could help that. And I think that will help the Forest Service. It'll help the local people feel like they're part of the solution instead of victims.
Okay. Thank you. Ken, same question back to you. Public lands, there's an active movement in Idaho promoting the transfer of federal lands to the state. Do you oppose or favor this effort?
Carl and I are spot on in agreement with this. We think the same way on this. I do not believe that the federal government can lose control of its federal lands and have it taken over by the state. But we can. There is an issue. There are problems with the maintenance and of the federal lands. We do need to have this solved by having a collaborative effort taking place. The federal government can't do this. Their hands are often tied by legal restrictions, lawsuits coming in. Those may be reduced if we start working together with people who have an interest in the land, the stakeholders, the federal government, the counties, private industry, working together to establish a working solution for the maintenance and care of our public lands. We need to keep those federal lands federal. Those are national forests. Those aren't Idaho state lands. Those are national forest lands.
Okay. Thank you.
I just want to remind our listeners, we're in the studio of KRFY, and right after our interview with Carl Crabtree and Ken Myers, who are running candidates for the Senate in District 7, we will have Jessica Chilcott and Priscilla Giddings, who are District 7 House Seat A candidates. So don't go away. We're going to have an extended KRFY morning show going into the 9 o'clock hour. Another question would be, there's a lot of division on the federal in the federal government, call it polarized electorate right now, and it's also in Idaho. What are some of your ideas to bridge the ideological divide so that government can avoid the sort of paralysis it seems to be caught in? Basically, how would you work together with all Idahoans and meet all Idahoans' needs and hopes and wants? And we'll start with Ken.
Thank you, Susie. This is a real difficult issue when you have people that are polarized and are not willing to compromise and aren't willing to work together for a common solution. We have that in northern Idaho. We have legislators who are on board or were here and have been were removed in this last election. One of them, thank you, Carl. The other is coming up into the election where we have a very right-wing person who is very conservative, who is running against a moderate Democrat, who will have an electoral base based on Democrats, independents who have a common view, which they work with each other to try to generate and create a legislative agenda that will be successful and we can get things done. So I think that a way to do that is to elect people from your districts who will be reasonable people, who will not be tied into ideologies, who will be able to work for the good of the people, not just for the good of the person that's being elected.
And the same question, Carl, how can we work together to really meet the needs of our citizens here in Idaho?
Well, I have had some experience in doing this. In the cattle industry, I think anybody who knows people in the cattle business, they're pretty hard-nosed and there's some diverse opinions and they do not like to back off of those. I have also worked with within the weed business and got cattlemen and Forest Service people together to agree on weed issues. I think it starts with respect. I think we need to respect both sides of any opinion, whether they're the, quote, liberal or they're quote, conservative. I think they all have the right to their opinion, and we can always work on finding something we can agree on. Now, we're not going to agree on many things, probably. And like when we worked with the cattlemen and the Forest Service over weed issues, they could not agree on fences. They could not agree on AUMs. They could not agree on water use. They could not agree on anything much. But we found that we could agree on weeds were the problem. So we began to develop problems on weeds. And then after we found the solutions on weeds, and through working together, then we were able to talk maybe a little about fences, then a little more about AUMs or whatever, and we could find common ground and begin to expand relationships. So we begin this relationship building with respecting each other's opinions and go from there.
Okay.
And just to follow up on that, Carl, how do you respect opinions if they're so diverse on an extreme side? How do you bring that conversation with those legislators that might be on an extreme side only? How do you bring them into the conversation and working together?
Well, you're never going to probably get everybody to agree, but you can get a majority to agree by respecting their opinion, hearing it, and then maybe there are some other things that you can agree on first and develop some sort of a relationship with them, and then talk about the controversial ones. But if you just draw the line in the sand, duke it out over that, you'll get where we are.
Okay. I think we have time to squeeze in one more question before we ask you each for a kind of a closing statement. And this is a very topical one. It concerns faith healing. Just this week, a special legislative committee held hearings down in Boise on Idaho's so-called faith healing law that provides an exemption from possible charges of child abuse, injury, or manslaughter if children are denied medical care due to the religious beliefs of their parents. Idaho is one of only a handful of states that provide this religious exemption. Would you favor or oppose such an the existing exemptions, actually, that Idaho has on this issue? Carl, start with you.
Well, I haven't tracked this legislation, but I have a general philosophy about what government's role with regard to people's lives, and that is get out of it. I don't believe that government should be invading people, particularly trying to legislate morality. I think that's an area where you want to talk about getting into conflict. We can certainly do that at any time when we start to legislate morality. So for me, it's about getting government out of our lives, not increasing involvement. I don't know this legislation specifically, but that is my philosophy with regard to work. And that comes from my business background. I've dealt with this cattle industry all my life, and the government has often been very challenging, but probably a necessary part, but to a lesser extent.
Okay. This is a tough one because you balance the welfare of the children against the beliefs of the parents that say, no, I'm not going to give them medical attention. And it was a pretty a very emotional hearing they had in Boise on Monday. Ken, same question to you on this exemption for faith healing.
It is a very emotional issue. I believe that the parents should not have the right to determine the life and death of their child. I don't think that that religious exemption should occur. I think we need to remove it. They are making decisions on someone who it's their responsibility. They have their child, and they are moving into an area which obviously the child is sick. The child needs medical care. Sometimes if they don't get that medical care, you can lead to disastrous consequences and the loss of life. Those decisions, whether they lose loss of life or not, are going to directly affect that child. This is going to be something under their control, under their, they are the parent. They have the right to have the child be involved with whatever education, but not have the right to determine whether the child will live or die, seek medical help or not.
Okay. And that pretty much handles as much as we can squeeze in our time here for questions. We'd like to give you each an opportunity to make a closing statement. And we'll go ahead and start with you, Ken. And also tell us how people can get in touch with you if they want to learn more about your candidacy.
Sure. Thank you, Chris. They could get hold of, they could go to my website, Ken Myers, excuse me, that's ken.myers.ruck.us, or they can go to my Facebook page, or they can call me at home, 208-265-7251. I got into this because what was happening in Boise was driving me crazy. What was happening were based on things that were being done and things that were not being done, the sins of omission and the sins of commission. We have a legislature that has been Republican for strong Republican since the Great Recession. We haven't done well with that legislature, with them leading us out of this recession. Things are being done. We talk about money coming back into schools to get funding. We're now funding at the 2009 levels. Those were low then. They're low now. If we don't take education seriously, if we don't start moving forward with education to try to develop ways in which we can educate our students for the 21st century economy, our economy won't improve and the lives that we have, our well-being will not improve.
Okay. Same to you, Carl Crabtree. Closing statement, and please let us know how your constituents can get in touch with you.
Okay, well, thank you, Chris and Susie and KRFY. It's been a real opportunity for us to visit with the folks and a way to do that in an area that for me is very hard to do because I don't live here. And so I look forward to contact information from listeners. That would be at crabtree4senate.com. That's my website. It has the ability to put in your contact information and wait for you to contact me. And so that's the way we want to get together. I see myself as a common sense kind of guy that is running for this position to try to bring a balance of experience with private business, the cattle business, with having worked in government as well. Seeing both sides of it, I think, allows me to represent people better in terms of seeing it from a business perspective, but understanding that government does have a limited role that we need to work within. So I think that background, coupled with experience with working with people and learning about how to develop relationships within government and business, I think will help me provide leadership for this district and success for those of us living here.
Okay. Well, we want to thank both of you, candidates for District 7 Senate seat, Carl Crabtree and Ken Myers, thanks for coming in. Thanks for sharing your stand on issues and who you are so that our listening audience and the voters in our area can have a better picture and get inspired to get out and vote. That's the point of it all. We're going to hear a song right now, and then we're going to be back in the studios with Legislative District 7 House Seat A candidates Jessica Chilcott and Priscilla Giddings. But let's get to the song. This is a Bruno Mars song. It's called Count on Me. And the reason I'm playing this one today is last Saturday, October 8th, was his birthday. He was born in 1985. So this is Bruno Mars, Count on Me. We'll be right back with more of the morning show. Stay with us, and thank you. And that was Bruno Mars, Count on Me. You're tuned in to the KRFY Morning Show, and this is Susie Prez and my co-host Chris Bessler. And we're back in the studios with our second group of guests, the District 7 House candidates that are in a contested race, House Seat A, Jessica Chilcott. Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning, Susie.
And Priscilla Giddings. Good morning, Priscilla.
Good morning, Susie. Such a great opportunity to be with you here on this frosty fall morning.
Yep. And let's get started. Chris, do you want to?
Sure. It's going to be pretty much the same format. You both had a chance to hear us talking with the Senate candidates for District 7. So we'd like to start out with just an introductory statement from each of you. And if you can give us a little bit about your background, your education and employment, how long you've lived in the district, and why you're running for legislature. And Priscilla, we'll start with you. Priscilla, by the way, you are the Republican candidate, and Jessica, you are the Democratic candidate. So, Priscilla, you're first.
Sure, Chris. Thank you. I grew up down in the Riggins area, graduated from high school at Salmon River High School in Riggins. My mother was the principal, and my dad was the deputy sheriff at the time, and he's now the Idaho County Sheriff. So I was a straight arrow from the beginning. And I really grew up with values of serving, and my father served in Vietnam, and he encouraged me to join the military. And so from a young age, at the age of 10, I decided I wanted to go to the Air Force Academy and give back to the community and our nation. And so I went to the Air Force Academy in 2001, graduated there in 2005, and then was selected to go on to be a pilot, and then was selected to become a fighter pilot and fly the A-10 Warthog, which was my first choice and an absolutely incredible aircraft and experience. Your first flight, you were flying alone by yourself. And your fourth flight, you get to fire the Gatling gun, which is a remarkable experience. From there, my first assignment was in Germany, so I had the opportunity to live overseas and learned a lot about how European governments work, which was very revealing. Had the opportunity to travel to more than 30 different countries while I was in the active duty. From there, I flew a variety of other aircraft, had three combat deployments, and separated from active duty 2 years ago, joined the Idaho Air National Guard down in Boise. Just a little shout out to all my friends in the Air National Guard. Currently, our A-10 unit is flying overseas, fighting against ISIS, and they will be back at the end of this month. So they will definitely appreciate your thoughts and prayers. I had the opportunity when I separated from, actually switched from the Guard into the Reserves. So I am currently a major in the Air Force Reserves. I also had some downtime, and I wanted to just keep serving in Idaho. So I helped one of our previously elected officials down in the Capitol. And every day for 3 months, I just helped. And I saw that there is a lot more that can be done to represent our district. It's a very unique district, and I wanted to just give back and continue serving.
Great. Thank you very much. Have you held elective office previously?
No, I have not.
First time. Okay.
Yes.
All right. Same question to you, Jessica Chilcott. Give us a bit about your background and why are you running for legislature?
So I grew up in Tennessee, and we moved out here when I was a sophomore in high school, and I actually graduated from Horseshoe Bend High School. And with a funny thing I think about is that there's a darn good chance that if Priscilla and I were closer together in age, we would have played volleyball against each other in high school.
Definitely.
Because my school went up that far north. And then I moved to Moscow after I graduated from high school. I attended the University of Idaho, attended Lewis Clark State College. And then ultimately, I made my way up to Sandpoint because that's where my parents were living at the time. And I've held a variety of social work positions up here. About 3 years ago, I went back to Boise State University and got my master's degree in social work. And so currently I'm working as a therapist in here in Sandpoint, serving Bonner County. So I got involved in politics because I have an abiding love of policy. And the work I was doing in 2013 as a case manager and moving forward from there, and I became very concerned about the state of our mental health and developmental disability systems in Idaho. And at some point of time, I developed a pretty strong awareness that if you are not at the table, you were on the menu. And I felt that it was important for people within my industry, specifically being like therapists, CBRS workers, case managers, developmental therapists, habilitative support people, that kind of thing. It was important for us to have someone who was going to be a strong voice for the work that we do every day. And I felt like we were not getting that from the previous seat holder who it was apparent that she felt she was completely unaccountable to anybody who lived in the district. And so I ran in 2014, I ran against her, and then I ran again in 2016. So,
have you held elective office previously?
I'm a precinct committee person, so.
That counts, you bet. So.
There you go, and thank you for those introductions. We want to ask each of you to describe maybe one or two, maybe three of the top issues you believe are most important and why you believe they are important and your position on these issues. And we'll start with Jessica.
So my top three issues right now is kind of, and I think the pieces of them are all kind of gathered. For me personally, my number one issue is mental health access in the state of Idaho. Protecting that, like, our vulnerable populations with mental health access, with developmental disability services, that kind of thing. That's why I got involved. It's my number one piece. And then you kind of have that conversation about education and the economy and how they're intertwined, and you can't really have a solid economy without a good educational foundation. And at the same time, it's really hard to make a good educational system without a solid economy. And so those are two really big issues for me that kind of get wrapped up together. And then there's some kind of minutia things, like I've become very concerned about how the state of Idaho writes and monitors its contracts. I think that everybody in the state should be a little bit concerned about how the state writes and monitors its contracts. So those are kind of my big three and a half, maybe.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Susie. I would say there are a handful of issues that I am really passionate about, and I would definitely encourage people to go online to my website, PriscillaForDistrict7.com, and also on my Facebook page. You can look up Priscilla Giddings for District 7. The three that I just come to mind right now, number one is strengthening our rural communities. Idaho is such a rural state, and District 7 is even more rural. I mean, we have 18,000 square miles of land in this district, and 75% of that is federal land in our resources. And our communities are just really taking a huge hit. It's affecting our families. It's affecting the cost of living. Our roads and bridges is part of that. Just down the East Kuski Bridge, it's used constantly, but the state can't afford to repair it. And so there are businesses in that area that are going to be potentially shut down, and it could affect the whole city. And that's there again, affecting our rural communities. The second one is the regulatory burden, even at the state level. The regulations are just stifling our businesses. Just a couple quick examples. The Kamiai Grain Mill was fined $100,000 because they had too much dust in the air around their grain mill. Another huge bird factory, we'll call it, up in our district, being fined by Fish and Game because of regulations that aren't even written in a book anywhere. And that's greatly affecting business because they produce and provide birds to the whole Western United States. And so the regulatory burden is just outrageous. And at the state level, there are things that legislators can do to help that. And then lastly, the third is just our natural resources, huge in District 7. And every morning when I wake up, I hear something on the news on where we are not able to access our resources and use our resources. Just this morning on the radio driving in today, shutting down more access to our forests just right here in the Sandpoint area. I know this summer the Forest Service came out with they call it the DRAM View Plan. So it's for motorized vehicles. And they're shutting down 51% of our roads right now while we're sitting here talking. And so not having access to our resources, it's killing our tourism. It's killing our incomes as rural communities. And those things just make me upset. And so I would like to get involved and help.
Okay. Thank you. We'll start with this next question with you, Priscilla. The economy and job creation are issues of concern that are identified by many of our region's residents. Do you consider this issue that the legislature should be working on? And if so, what kinds of actions can the legislature do to improve the economy and jobs?
Well, the real basic answer kind of goes back to my issues of reducing the regulatory burden. And then it is also, it's training our students. I'm actually surprised, even though our district has the highest unemployment rate in the state, there are a lot of help wanted signs up. And it's difficult talking with a lot of the business owners. It's difficult finding people who are trained in the areas that they need. So I definitely think the communication between our schools and our employers and Chamber of Commerce and trying to bridge that gap. I think the state can help. Yeah, I'm finding even being on the campaign trail, just connecting people and ideas and sharing lessons learned really can help. That's probably the most of it.
Okay, thanks. Jessica, same question to you. The economy and job creation, do you feel there's a role for the legislature in fostering economy and job creation? And what specific actions can the legislature take to do that?
Yes, I feel like the legislature has a role there. And I feel like it gets into those pieces where we talk about what is kind of the role of government in anything. And so it's the role of our state and county governments to ensure that we have infrastructure that works. So when we talk about our roads and bridges, and we talk about those things, and we have to be aware of the fact that if you're trying to sell something and you're coming out of Orofino and there's one road in and out, that road has to be maintained. If you are trying to drive through Kuski and there's a bridge that may or may not collapse under you, it makes it really hard to talk employers into setting up even light industry. So, I've had conversations with some of the economic development people around the district, and there's pieces of what do they need, and having that conversation, because what does the community need, and then how does the legislature support that within the role that we've been assigned based on statute in the Constitution? What can we do? Is there a way that the legislature can support increasing access to broadband? That's a huge issue. We look at Bonner County and the number of we're trying to become this tech hub up here. We look at those things, and so it's like, what can we do within the role of supporting the work that's being done in the communities? And then going back to that, that education piece of how do we support, not everybody needs or wants a 4-year college degree. Not everybody's going to be an English major. Not everybody's going to go be a social worker. So how do we support, the blue collar work? And then also, how do we support some of those soft skills that the business community is saying are lacking in our high school students coming out? Like, how do we support the education around those pieces?
Follow-up question. Actually, we're going to turn to that, but follow-up question that for each of you here. Most states are increasing the minimum. Many states are increasing their minimum wage, and some to as high as $15 an hour. Idaho's minimum wage is the same as the federal minimum wage, which is $7.25 an hour. Jessica, should Idaho increase its minimum wage?
That's a hard question. I would love to see the minimum wage increase on a personal level, but at the same time, I think that we need to be careful about how we have that conversation, because if we're increasing the minimum wage and it's only going up enough that someone's losing, because you're not going to bring somebody out of poverty, which would be the whole point of increasing the minimum wage, is helping people, like lift people out of poverty. And you can't do that if by giving them a raise, they have lost their Medicaid, they lose their subsidized housing, and they lose their insurance for their kids. That's not going to solve the problem. That just creates like a whole different problem, a different kind of problem. And so, but at the same time, like we have to be conscientious of the fact that we don't live in Seattle. And so while a $15 an hour minimum wage may work in Seattle, I don't know that that's really going to be able to fly, in Stites, Idaho. That, our communities and our local economies maybe won't be able to support that. So I think it's absolutely a conversation we need to have, but I don't necessarily know what that would look like.
Okay. Priscilla, same question to you. Should we increase the minimum wage in Idaho?
Absolutely not. I believe in empowering our businesses and our business owners to pay their employees what they need to be able to have a productive business. And thankfully, in America, we have so many freedoms. And one of those freedoms as employers and as employees is to be able to choose where we want to work. So I encourage people to find a job where they're paying you what you want to make.
Okay.
Okay, and that kind of gets back to some other things you've already mentioned. I do want to say, I'm going to give our legal ident here because it's the top of the hour. This is 88.5 KRFY Ponderay. And we're going to continue with our interview with Jessica Chilcott and Priscilla Giddings, both candidates for District 7 House Seat A. And moving to education, the state's budget for education was cut back drastically in 2009 during the recession. And as the economy improved, that state funding also increased to 7.4% to $1.58 billion. This was less than what the governor proposed. He proposed 7.9%. And so the question is, and we'll start with Priscilla, do you favor or oppose increased funding for education? And if you support increased funding, how should the state pay for it?
Great. Thank you. I will go back. I really enjoyed Carl Crabtree's comments earlier where he remarked that we don't need more money to solve all of our education problems. However, I strongly believe in a limited government, but I do think the role of government, even in our Idaho state constitution, is to provide an education for all of our children. And so revitalizing our rural schools in District 7 is huge for me. And I absolutely agree that we need to fully fund our schools to the maximum extent possible. And that means a lot. And there's a lot of issues behind that. I had the opportunity to meet with the Region 2 superintendents 2 weeks ago. And my ears are full from their comments on what really needs to happen. And there's a lot of frustration from our teachers and our educators, even our superintendents, that they don't feel like they're being heard down in Boise. And so I took all of that to heart. And I really have a heart for helping our schools, especially our rural schools. It's hard to believe that in District 7, we have school buildings that were built in 1910. And yet you drive down to Boise and there are beautiful schools mm-hmm. that were just built a few years ago. And so I think it's very important that we look at several different aspects of that. Right now, there's actually a current legislative working group that is working on the funding formula for our school districts. And they're having a public meeting on Monday, the 17th, down at North Idaho College at 11 a.m. And there's public comment from 5 to 7. So I would encourage educators, if they're available, to go down there and let legislators know how you feel about how the funding is affecting our rural schools. I do support the big things that our current superintendents are asking for are funding the career ladder and covering just basic operational mm-hmm. Expenses. And sadly, they're not putting forward a lot more of their requests because they think it will get denied because there's not enough money. So there was, I think in the news last month, there are some, there's more money coming in this year than expected. And I fully support putting that money straight into education.
Thank you. And Jessica, the same question. Do you support increased funding for education? If you support this, how should the state pay for it?
So, yeah, I think Priscilla and I are pretty much in agreement. I imagine she and I have talked to a lot of the same people that we have. You know, we have it's an incredibly rural district. District 7 is. And so and I would. You know, when we talk about like how the funding system got changed back in 2008, and that was pretty devastating for our rural schools, not just in District 7, but all over the state. It was pretty devastating. And so now we're in this position where it feels like, whether it's accurate or not, it feels like every year we're having the school districts are having to go back to their home communities and ask the voters, are you willing to accept another property tax increase? Are you willing to accept another property tax increase because we can't afford books and we can't afford teachers and we can't afford our power bill? And that's completely unacceptable when the Idaho State Constitution says that the state will provide a thorough and uniform system of public education. And, you know, and when you're driving through the state, you can, between Cottonwood and Lapway and Grangeville, you can tell that that's not happening in the state of Idaho. We're, you know, our kids are not getting a uniform and thorough system of public education. So yes, we absolutely, you know, and I'm not saying that our, like, our teachers are trying to do a very good job. Our schools are trying to do a very good job. And I, you know, I kind of bristle up about the idea, you know, that I've heard some people say about you can't just throw money at a problem. Well, sometimes that's exactly what you need to do, is make, you know, planning careful decisions about what's the problem, how do we fix it. Sometimes that takes money. So we absolutely need to be putting more money into our educational system. We can, on one hand, say that we want to go back and offer more vocational technical training in our high schools, and at the same time say, but we're not going to fund that, because that gets into that conversation about those unfunded mandates that make everybody unhappy. So there's a couple different things. I, you know, kind of going back to having the conversation about the Medicaid expansion, which I know we're going to get to later, so I'm not going to belabor that point. And then also kind of having some conversations about, do we look at an internet sales tax for online purchases? You know, we're going to have to find the money somewhere, because otherwise it's going to cost us more in the long run.
Susie, can I throw one fact in there based on what Jessica said? She referenced back in 2006, it was Governor Risch who changed school funding from property tax to income tax. And since he did that, 95 out of our 116 school districts have had to run supplemental levies. That's unheard of.
Back to property tax.
Yes, and in fact, that's a, it's become de rigueur for all districts basically to run supplemental levies now. And in our school district here, that accounts for a third of their operating expenses. So if it failed to pass one year, there'd be some serious cutbacks in schools. On to a new question here. The Affordable Care Act is now in place, and Idahoans actually have signed up at one of the highest per capita rates in the country. But there's one provision in the law that permits states to expand Medicaid to cover an estimated 60,000 to 80,000 Idahoans who make too much to qualify for Medicaid, but not enough to be eligible for subsidies on the state insurance exchange. Last legislative session, lawmakers adjourned without agreeing on a solution to this. What action, if any, do you favor to cover the health care coverage gap for lower-income Idahoans? And Priscilla, we'll go with you first.
Okay, thank you, Chris. Oh, what a tough, tough issue. Specifically talking about the gap in expanding Medicaid, my heart initially goes to our veterans, because in Idaho's gap right now, there's about 4,000 veterans that are in there. And that really affects me, just because, I mean, I'm a veteran and all, and I have so many friends that fall into that category, and our veterans just really do need our support. And we also have a story in District 7, an Orofino man had a kidney stone, and he couldn't afford the prescription that the doctor gave him. And it affected him so greatly that he crashed his car because of it and ended up dying. And just a tragic story on such a simple solution. That being said, it's a complicated subject. So when we look specifically at the two bills for the Medicaid expansion and closing the gap that were presented in the Idaho legislature last year, there was a lot of doubts and questions about how big that gap really is. And now that we're getting more and more numbers, it's kind of difficult to measure. In District 7, and it's actually in Idaho County where we're looking up the numbers, and it was like less than 100. And we were thinking, there's no way possible. Well, there's so many people that aren't even filling out the paperwork. So those numbers are probably shy of what it really could be. But it's also interesting that there's about 54% of the numbers of people who have actually submitted, they're actually under the age of 34. And a lot of them are in school and living at home with their parents. And so it almost seems like the previous bills that were presented act as an umbrella for a lot of people, and many of whom don't even need free coverage. So that worries me, because I want to take care of the real indigent people who really need help, and not just blanket in everybody. Because as soon as you blanket in everybody, there is a cost that is exponential that you cannot put your hands on. And I like numbers, and I want to see what's going to happen before I make a big decision. And so looking at those numbers, figuring out what it really is, I think that there is a solution to repair our Idaho's current Medicaid program. And I'm hearing lots of different ideas on that I think I can support and get behind. But just closing the entire gap, I think, would be fiscally irresponsible.
Okay. Thank you, Priscilla. Jessica, same question to you. What, if any, action do you favor to cover the health care coverage gap for lower income
Idahoans? I feel like we need to close the gap. End of sentence. It's not up to me to decide whether or not somebody truly deserves to have the care based on their income they would qualify. And, you know, and there are a lot of heartbreaking stories. I'm assuming Priscilla's getting the same letters I get every month. Every month I get letters from people who are like, I am sick, I am dying, and I can't get care. And I find that to be morally unacceptable, that we're living in a first world nation and we are allowing people to die unnecessarily. People are dying from asthma. I mean, that was one of the big stories that was in the legislature, is the woman down in southeastern Idaho who died as a result of her asthma. You know, these things happen, and it's unacceptable. And so I feel like whether it looks like something like one of the plans that the legislature came out with, and I mean, some of them were kind of horrible, or whether or not we just accept the straight Medicaid expansion, the regulatory environment already exists in the doctor's offices and the anesthesiologists and the emergency rooms to accept Medicaid. So that would not change. The regulatory would not change, because all of these clinics, all of these facilities are already set up to accept Medicaid. And then at the end of the day, like, the people who have run the numbers are projecting that it's a $5.1 million positive fiscal impact in the state just in the first year. And looking at over $160 million over the first 5 years of positive fiscal impact from people who are able to access care, and so they're able to stay at work, from people, you know, from the ability for the state to reduce the catastrophic fund, the ability for our counties to eliminate their indigent funds, their indigent health care funds. You know, Clearwater County has $313,000 in their indigent fund. Shoshone County has over $300,000, and they were looking at having to put almost $500,000 in their indigent fund. And it gets a little hinky because there's some other things that inexplicably got put in to be paid for out of that fund. But at the end of the day, it's a program that we're already paying for as Idaho taxpayers. And I am not okay with allowing people to die when they don't have to.
Okay. Yes. Like a follow-up?
Yes, please. Just shortly. You know, when you start looking at the dollars and the numbers of the closing the gap issues, it's, you know, everybody has a different opinion and a different calculator. But the one thing that I really want the listeners and Idaho voters to know and understand is that no matter which proposal goes forward, the state does have a small percentage that they have to cover. Even if the federal government's going to save the day with all this money, the state still has money that it has to provide. And where does that money come from? The general fund. And so the more money that comes out of the general fund is directly taken out of our education. And I totally disagree with that. I think our kids should be first.
Okay. You also have, Jessica, you want to follow up?
I feel like allowing the parents of our children to access health care so that they're not worried about whether or not they're going to be able to keep their job does benefit our children. And there are cost savings that will be experienced from in the indigent funds and in the CAT fund. And so I feel like there's been a pretty decent coalition of pretty smart people who have put together. And yes, the state will have a have some cost burden, but we're already paying for these. We're paying for our people who can't get health care in hospitals, having small hospitals, critical access hospitals, having to write off millions of dollars in care every year. We're paying for it when people can't go to work. We're paying for it in indigent funds. We're paying for it through CAP funds. And so I feel like we're already paying for it.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. This is something I've heard. We're kind of, I'm veering off a little bit from our script, but it is part of health. Mental health service access and disability service access. How does Idaho measure up? And we'll start with you, Jessica. This is one of your issues. How does Idaho measure up in mental health and disability service access to those services? And if it needs to be better, how can we make it better? How can a legislator make it better?
Oh, I'm first.
Yeah, you're first, Jessica.
Well, I think that there's a couple different things. And for me, part of it goes back to how are we writing the contracts? How are we writing the contracts? And I'm, you know, and thinking specifically at this point in time about our public mental health services, which largely serves children, because that is my wheelhouse. That's kind of where I work. Excuse me. And so thinking specifically about that, I don't necessarily know how we measure up to our neighbors. I don't have that. But I can tell you how we're measuring up now versus how we measured up in 2012, and it's not great. We are, and unfortunately, yes, like these services can be expensive, but we're paying out millions of dollars every month to a mental health contractor, and people aren't getting access to care. And so what are we paying them for? At the end of the day, what are we paying them for? If they're getting millions of dollars from us every month and people in our services can't access care, why are we giving them this money? And we authorized an OPE study, and I believe Priscilla was there the day that the OPE study was read as well, because I think that's the day you and I first met. And one of the things that came out of that study was that the state of Idaho needs to pay attention to its contracts. We are writing contracts. We're paying out millions of dollars, millions and millions of dollars every year, and we don't necessarily have a good way to monitor whether or not we're getting what we're paying for, and we don't necessarily have a good way to ensure that we're getting what we thought we were paying for, and I find that hugely problematic. So okay. It all kind of gets wrapped up together for me.
Okay. Thank you. Same question, Priscilla. Do you want me to repeat it? Okay. So how does Idaho measure up on services for mental health services and disability and access to those services? And if we need to do better, how can we do better?
Yeah, as far as measuring up, if you compare us to other states, I think we're 49th. Yeah, it's horrible. It just pulls on all of our heartstrings. I know that the legislature has been, slowly working on it. I know the governor has been slowly proposing new ideas. I've seen several proposals for building some new structures. I know a lot of people are getting behind the idea. We only currently have two state hospitals, and they are full. Mm-hmm. And there's waiting lists longer than the number of beds that they have. Mm-hmm. And so there is a huge concern. And that puts pressure on our law enforcement as well, because they are the ones that end up having to deal with it. And they don't have room or the skills or the training to deal with a lot of these issues. And the issue just goes so much deeper. I mean, just looking at the numbers, we've got a veteran every day commits suicide because of behavioral health concerns. Here in Idaho, we are having a huge problem with youth suicide. I mean, the CDC reports just came out a few months ago, and Idaho is the worst for having the number of students who are attempting suicide. And in our district, Shoshone County, I just was spent Saturday with them. They were having a fun run event to just educate the population about the suicide concerns in Shoshone County. They did a 5K fun run and walk. And talking with the local school counselors, one lady, she said she will go in her elementary school and ask how many of the students know someone who's committed suicide. And she said almost every single one of them raises their hand. And so the issue just spreads far and wide through all of our schools and in our entire state. As far as what the legislature can do about it, I do support ideas about building facilities and trying to recruit healthcare providers into Idaho, too. I mean, that's a huge thing. We really need to think about it. The state level is we need to be recruiting people. I mean, this is the best place in the world to live. Mm-hmm. You know, in Idaho and in our district, I firmly believe it. It's the best place in the world to live. And we need to be telling people, but the people are here. And I think Idaho's in the top 10 list of people moving to Idaho. And so we need to get out in front of that and prepare the facilities and the structure to be able to handle these huge issues.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
We've got time for just another question or two. Let's talk about public lands and I think we start with Jessica on this one. There is an active movement within Idaho promoting a transfer of federal lands to the state. Do you favor or oppose this effort, and why?
I oppose the effort, but I do agree that we need to come together and find a way to do shared management. You know, I feel like we have some really good examples of models that could work. For talking about how are these public lands going to be managed? How are they going to be managed for multi-use? Because it's not just about how are we managing for logging or mining. How are we managing for, our billion-dollar tourism industry? And so we have multi-use needs on these lands. And we can look at the Clearwater Basin Collaborative. We can look at the work that's being done with the collaborative up in Boundary County. And so is there a way to take that model and make it work in our communities? Because there does need to have a conversation around what the community needs, what the state needs. And at the same point of time, like, you know, what did the federal government feel that it needs to be successful, and putting that together to ensure that, you know, because our communities count on our federal lands. They're like three different places, Headwaters Economics, among others, have talked about how having our public lands actually creates a resiliency for our communities, for our rural communities. There's resiliency there. So how do we build on that resiliency at the same time being able to utilize our forests for multi-use?
Okay, thank you. Same question to you, Priscilla. Do you favor or oppose the movement to transfer federal lands to the state?
Okay, Chris, thank you. I'm probably going to need more than 2 minutes on this one. this is a huge topic that I have been following closely for the last 2 years. So where to begin? I will start specifically with your question about transferring the title of the lands. I think that's kind of a red herring for the real issue. The only people who are actually working on land title transfer, the Utah legislature and the people voted for Utah to be able to spend $14 million on a lawsuit against the federal government to get their lands back. And I think that's currently on pause. That is the only actual piece of movement on the concept of transferring the actual title. What we really, the core of the issue comes down to two things: management, active management, and access. Those two things are what people are furious about, is that the current status quo is not working. This summer, I had the opportunity, as I'm a pilot currently, and I flew a contract for the Forest Service, and so I flew over all of the forests in District 7, and I got a firsthand view of how the health of our forest is, and I had the opportunity, a lot of the spotters sitting next to me, one was retired fish and game warden, and other Forest Service retirees, and they were absolutely very informative about the health of our forests. And it's not just about our forests, because right now our forests have never been more unhealthy. But it also, it affects our wildlife. Mm-hmm. The number of elk that are in the area are down by tens of thousands. And that directly relates to our hunters and our recreational income, which you can put a dollar amount to what each elk or wildlife, the cost for hunting is. And that is several millions of dollars being taken out of our rural communities, all because we don't have an active management plan. And it's not just our forests. I mean, it's also the minerals in our forests. I mean, there is a big push against all the different resources in our lands. I mentioned to you the Dramview plan that just this summer closed down 51% of our roads. The millions of dollars that we're losing for the hunting. There's also a move right now to put a 20-year ban on all mineral extraction. And I think we should use our good neighbor authority and play an active role in good management and access.
Thank you.
Guess what? We have a lot more questions, but we've sort of run out of time. And we want to remind our listeners of two things. We will be podcasting these two interviews that we had today with the Senate candidates and the House candidates from District 7. So you can go to our website, krfy.org, and listen to those again. If you didn't hear them originally or someone else wants to hear them, let them know. Also, I guess the Reader and Keoki or Sandpoint Online is going to be hosting a forum where you can again hear the candidates speak for themselves on various issues. Chris, you want to talk about that?
That's going to be on November 2nd at the high school auditorium. The start time is 5:30. It's going to run till 7:30 or maybe 8 if the candidates have a lot to say. And we hope you both will be able to make it. And I know it's a trip for you, Priscilla, since you live down so far down in that district, but you certainly are invited.
And we want to ask both of you to give your websites or your Facebook sites so that people can find out more about you, because that's what this program is about, informing our listeners.
Well, actually, we'd like to give them each about a minute or so to wrap up and let us know how, let your constituents know how they can get in touch with you. And Priscilla, we'll start with you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Chris and Susie. What a fun opportunity. I always love being in Sandpoint. I wish I was a millionaire and I could have a home up here, too. But my website information, Priscilla for District 7, .com, and then you can also look on Facebook, and Priscilla for District 7.
And that 4 is the number 4.
Yes. And if you just Google Priscilla Giddings, you'll find me, I promise. And a lot of issues. Idaho is the best place in the world to live, but there's so much more that we can do. And I just want everybody to know that you can call me, you can email me, you can text me. I want to represent you, District 7 voters. So let me know what's on your mind. Thank you.
And Jessica.
So I can be found at chilcottforidaho.ruck.us. Also, like, it goes back to that. If you Google Jessica Chilcott Idaho, you'll find me. If you don't add the Idaho, there is a softball player in the Midwest who will also come up, and she's just really having a stellar season. last spring, she had an excellent season, so very proud of that, Jessica Chilcott as well. So, yeah, my phone number is 208-304-2906. Please call me. I will get back to you. Jessica.chilcott@gmail.com. I'm available. There are many things. There are, you know, as Priscilla said, there are many things that deserve to be worked on. And we have a district that is ready to be represented by people who are going to pay attention and who are going to respond, and who are willing to be held accountable for their actions. So, and I just want to remind everybody that early in-person voting started in Bonner County yesterday. So I think we were the last county to start the early in-person voting. So you can go down to the county building as of yesterday and vote.
Get her done.
Yep.
As they say. Well, we really, again, appreciate your coming in from far and near and sharing with our listeners your perceptions and ideas about how to make Idaho a great place, that it already is, but how to improve and continue. Next week, our guests on the KRFY morning show on Wednesday, the 19th, for this Local Decision 2016 series will be District 1 House Seat B candidates Sage Dixon and Stephen F. Howlett. Sage Dixon is a Republican. Stephen F. Howlett is a Democrat. So you can join us again next week, Wednesday, October 19th at 8 o'clock for the morning show. And you can tune in tomorrow to the morning show with Jack Peterson.
And I think we're about out of time. We're way over time, actually.
Okay. We're going to go back to the rest of the day till 5 o'clock, Otto's Eclectic Mix. We're going to start off with Bird Notes. We hope you have a beautiful day.
Yes. Bye. See you next week.